Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, Emily McCord has this week's Politics Ohio. Poet Ed Davis pays a visit to Conrad's Corner. And we'll hear about a landmark in Northeast Ohio that's turning 100 this year. Up first, for nearly a year, Ohio's governor and auditor have been pushing local governments to trim the fat in their budgets, even merge jurisdictions altogether if possible. Townships, a form of government that predates Ohio statehood, are a popular part of many restructuring plans, with leaders of Ohio's more than 1,300 townships convening in Columbus for a conference this past week. Steve Brown of Ohio Public Radio Station WOSU decided to check in on the state of the township.
In rural Union County, there isn't much there. Some plowed fields, a few country gas stations, and Dover Township.
We're basically an agricultural township.
With a pretty small budget.
$780,000
a year to cover all township expenses. There aren't many, a few cemeteries to keep up, some gravel roads to pave and plow, and a few others. It's a modest form of government, but one that Dover Township trustee Ron Miller says suits him and his constituents, most of whom he knows from living in the area since 1954.
Someone calls and says they have a problem. We deal with it, whether it's zoning, whether they have other issues. I don't feel that adding more people to the county or state government would answer that problem.
But Governor John Kasich does think shrinking local government can solve some financial problems. He helped pass a state budget that will eventually cut Ohio's local government fund in half, then formed a commission to, in his words, give local governments the tools they need. Auditor David Yost has been one of the plan's biggest advocates. His office operates the website skinnyohio.org, which offers tips for townships and other governments trying to cut or merge services.
I intend to be a salesman for this process, and as we see townships or counties that are in a position where this could make a big difference for them, I'm going to sit down and talk with people. I'm going to have my staff out there knocking on doors and trying to convince them that this is the way to go.
As a matter of public policy, it's not sound.
Matt DeTemple directs the Ohio Township Association. He says many of his members have been dealing with falling property taxes and shrinking budgets for years and are even more concerned with the new policy coming out of Columbus. DeTemple says contrary to comments from state leaders, studies funded by his group show keeping townships is actually cheaper than folding them into state government.
It's a little counterintuitive, but if you look at the studies, you know, states that have a lot of local government tend to have a lower cost of government overall.
While more and more Ohio townships are sharing things like water and sewer service, none have completely consolidated. Nancy White is a trustee in Mifflin Township in suburban Columbus. She says total mergers are likely not too far down the road.
There are some townships that unfortunately only provide maybe a small services such as roads, that type thing, and they're not going to be able to hang on. And I can see where possibly some of the larger townships will get even larger by consolidating with some of the smaller townships to provide services.
Mifflin Township definitely ranks among the larger, more financially secure townships. It's headquartered in downtown Gahanna and offers plenty of services like trash pickup, water and sewer service, and a fire department.
This right here is basically an SCBA in our pack, and it's set up in case firefighter is trapped.
As Lieutenant Mark Hendricks gives me a tour of the station and its million-dollar fire engine, he says closing even rural fire stations would be dangerous.
When you consolidate, that means you're spreading people out. That means longer response times. You know, so if you consolidate or you take away one of my stations, it's a longer response time to help somebody.
That tension, the push and pull between townships and state government, is one of the overriding themes of this week's Ohio Township Association Winter Conference. For Ohio Public Radio, I'm Steve Brown in Columbus.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, Conrad's Corner, but first, more news from around Ohio. A cultural crossroads in Northeast Ohio turns 100 this year. Cleveland's West Side Market has been serving up fresh meat, produce, and vendors with attitude since 1912. WCPN reporters David C. Barnett and Brian Bull recently paid a visit to this popular operation to review its history and explore what the future has in store. In the first part of our series, we explore the personal connections to the market that have been forged over the course of a century. Our story begins with David Barnett.
From a distance, you might think it's a church. The tower that rises nearly 140 feet above this huge yellow brick building at West 25th and Lorraine serves as a marker that draws the faithful from across Greater Cleveland. But these congregants aren't as interested in spiritual sustenance as they are in getting a good deal for their dinner table.
We have natural dry fruit here.
Two for three, I give you one free. How many on six?
You can try free sample.
For nearly a century, shoppers have flocked to the Westside Market for fresh produce, meat, cheese, and baked goods, sold by vendors like Ricky Calabrese, whose family has a long history hawking fruits and vegetables.
It's 1919. My grandma started here when they came over from the boat.
It was a time before grocery stores, when thousands of immigrants from Italy, Germany, Hungary, and elsewhere were flooding into this near West Side community, just up the hill from the steel mills. Writer Mary Lou Susco says there was a big demand for the food they had left behind in Europe.
The West Side Market became a place where they would set up businesses, they would serve people from their own ethnicity, and they were able to find the products that they wanted here.
Susco and ethnic food expert Laura Taxel are collaborating on a new book that documents the market's history. Taxel says this building was part of a national movement to create municipal markets.
The idea was that people living in cities would have a source of good, affordable food. The fact that it was provided by city government was meant to be a service to the citizens.
And the city didn't skimp when it came to building the market. The architects were Dominic Bennis and Benjamin Hubble, who designed the Cleveland Museum of Art. Cutting-edge construction techniques were used to create the immense vaulted ceiling that floats above the din of vendors offering strudel samples and advice on how to prepare a beef brisket, just like Grandma used to make.
Even though many people are multiple generations away from their ethnic immigrant past, they come here to get certain foods that bring back a taste that perhaps is their only link to their ethnic identity.
And as Northeast Ohio's immigrant mix has changed, the market continues to reflect the food needs of the newcomers. There are now stands offering taste treats from places like Mexico, Cambodia, and Egypt.
I start first with the dry dates and figs for the, you know, American people doesn't know them.
Irene Zeno says she and her husband had a steep learning curve when they opened their dried fruit stand back in 2004.
First day I came here, I cried because I didn't sell that good. I make very, very low money.
Her husband wanted to sell the stand, but Irene wasn't so easily defeated. They regrouped, expanded the product line, and adopted a slightly more aggressive selling style. She says they've done well ever since.
7 years. That's not bad.
Jerry Chukre's family has been selling smoked meats at the market for over 50 years. He's fiddled with the family tradition a bit by adding a candy stand on the side. But sausages and beef jerky remain the big sellers. And a new sales staff may be just around the corner.
Well, right now my kids are both graduated from college. One's getting her master's in engineering, so I would hope she would stay with that. And the other one's going to be a math teacher. So I think, you know, they said they want to try it on their own. If they don't like it, they'll come back to the business.
In part two of our story, you'll hear whether Jerry's daughter is willing to step up to the plate. Also, some critics, including a very famous TV star, are calling for changes. Those voices are coming up as we look into the future of the West Side Market.
David C. Barnett with WCPN reporting on the history of the iconic West Side Market in Cleveland. Operators and vendors alike want to see the market go on for at least another century, but proposed changes are creating some friction. WCPN's Brian Bull explores the West Side Market's future in the second half of this series, beginning with a vendor whose family has run several counters at the market for decades.
I'm here with Amanda Shukre at the candy counter. First off, Amanda, do you think you'll carry on the tradition?
I really think I will. My parents are quite a few years from retiring, so I kind of wanted to branch myself out and try to do something with my degree, but I have a good feeling that I will be back here very soon.
Amanda may be back, but the West Side Market she and her parents have known for years will be different if city planners have their way. Just how to keep the market around for another century has sparked some prickly debate. City Councilman Joe Simperman of Ward 3 says, for starters, hours should be more for customers, not vendors.
Nobody that I know gets off of work at 4 in the afternoon. So instead of being open from 7 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon on a Monday, what if we were open from noon until 8? You know, looking at things that make the market more user-friendly, but ultimately create greater revenue for the vendors who are there.
Other suggestions include opening the market for more than 4 days, a throwback to when Cleveland had several other markets. But for meat vendor Vince Bertinacci, these proposals cut to the bone.
I just separated the brisket from what they call the navel with a handsaw.
In a chilly, bloodstained prep space in the market basement, Bertinacci carves up beef. As president of the Westside Vendors Association, Bertinacci says the only changes for the market should be upgrades to its plumbing and electricity and expanding parking. Beyond that,
if it's not broke, don't fix it, please.
Bertinacci says vendors feel that if the city of Cleveland mandates new hours, it would cut into their prep time. There are also concerns that the city will more tightly regulate vendor leases, which could tie up the selling process or limit products. He says if officials aren't careful, the Westside Market could lose what makes it unique from grocery stores. He compares his meticulously trimmed cuts of beef to what's trucked into supermarkets for major beef processors.
Those companies are bigger than our steel mills used to be. Things have to get done in a hurry, not no fooling around. You can go into a store and this guy only does it because it's his job. Does he care? No. I do this because my heart's in it.
Many proposed changes are based on surveys conducted by Ohio City Incorporated, a private nonprofit partnered with the city of Cleveland. Its feasibility study is due out next month. Amanda Dempsey, the market district director for Ohio City, Inc., says that will help launch a capital campaign to fund improvements at the Westside Market.
Mechanical, structural, electrical, plumbing, sewer, accessibility, life safety, things like that, and a budget figure for each of those improvements.
Besides its centennial, the Westside Market will host the International Public Markets Conference this fall, another event that's prompting the fix-ups. The city has already allocated $400,000 for some electrical and plumbing upgrades. Ohio City, Inc. says at least $3 million more is needed and has been seeking private donors. The Westside Market is an enterprise fund operation with rent money from vendors as its main revenue source. Some have suggested privatizing the Westside Market to make its operations more consistent with other markets and to boost revenues. Comedian and Cleveland native Drew Carey and a member of the LibertarianReason.com site met with the Cleveland City Council in 2010.
My idea is to sell it to somebody who knows how to manage a market. If I wanted to be mean about it, I would open a market right next door to the Westside Market and put you out of business.
But others say the facility should remain public. Ken Silliman is the Cleveland mayor's chief of staff. He says while they're working towards complete financial self-sufficiency for the market, they won't privatize it.
We've done a very good job of preserving a unique local and national asset. The Westside Market's a major reason we are hosting the Public Markets Conference. The city has constructed the market. It's a real landmark in Cleveland. All that's happened under city ownership.
And then there are comparisons to other markets, like Pike Place Market in Seattle, where its flying fish stick draws tourists who love to see vendors hurl a halibut. Don't expect to be ducking, flying fish, sirloin, or baklava anytime soon in Cleveland. Amanda Dempsey of Ohio City, Inc. says she likes the energy Pike Place brings to its district, but the Westside Market has its own merits, rooted in a long-standing community tradition.
Our market is unique where we have a lot of vendors who have been at the market for generations, providing food on a daily or weekly basis for customers, where Pike Place is much more of a tourist attraction.
Just what changes lie ahead for the Westside Market is still being deliberated. But between the Centennial and International Public Markets Conference, Councilman Joe Simperman says change is definitely coming.
We can never become so apathetic to the fact that people have more choices now than ever to think that if it's well enough, leave it alone. That may work for today. That may get us through the Centennial. That's not going to get us to our sesquicentennial.
For Ohio Public Radio, I'm Brian Bull in Cleveland.
WCPN reporters Brian Bull and David C. Barnett reporting on Cleveland's West Side Market turning 100 this year. This is WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO.
This week on American Roots, pianist and composer Herbie Hancock. For 40 years, he's moved effortlessly from jazz through pop and funk, picking up a dozen Grammys along the way. Plus, the first family of New Orleans funk, Art, Charles, Aaron, and Cyril, the Neville brothers. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
This afternoon at 2 on WISO.
WISO is your public radio station, so let us know what's on your mind. Call the WISO listener line at 769-1374 and share your thoughts. Did we make a mistake? Did we get something right? Leave us your suggestions, comments, corrections. Maybe you've got a story to share. We'd love to hear from you, and we might use your comment on the air. So call the listener line, 769-1374.
Welcome to Conrad's Corner. From time to time, I do interviews. My guest today is Ed Davis from Yellow Springs. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Conrad. How are you?
I'm okay. The last time we talked, we sort of talked about poetry in general, and this time we're going to have more time for reading. So what have you to read?
Well, I've brought several poems, new ones and maybe some kind of old. I thought I would start with this one. That this one is probably 3 or 4 years old. I read it at the Antioch Writers' Workshop a while ago, and it's been published recently. And sort of as a kind of invocation called These Poems. Shall I let her rip?
Go.
These poems. These poems resist stain, won't wrinkle, shrink, or needlessly bleed. These poems speak Spanish, know Latin, and do higher math. Can fix flats, tie flies, tell lies with a granite face. They rocked my faith, quaked my innocence, cracked my skull wide to let in light, dust, and dreams. They played with the Stones at Altamont, Beatles at Shea, Elvis on a velvet Vegas stage. They never drink and drive, pay what they owe, lost and found Jesus 1,000 times. They watch me worse than God. Forgive me like friends, bless me like a father, pluck mandolins and frail banjos on Sunday afternoons, schmooze, razz, tisk, and grin like spinsters behind their hands. They've sometimes fought me, spoiled me like a mother, spurned me like a lover, and covered me on nights I fled my bed too heartsick to sleep. I've left these poems behind 100 million times, lying in ditches, tossed thoughtlessly from speeding cars, buried deep on cemetery ridges. But these poems, abiding like blood, cleaving like flesh, true as wounds, never left me.
Oh, is that pretty autobiographical?
Of course.
Of course. Not all poets.
That's true. That's true. You use your poetic license whenever you want to. But, yeah, I see this as being autobiographical, unashamedly.
And can you talk a little more about the ending, Never Left Me? It's left you because it's here on a piece of paper.
Yeah, but it's about kind of faith. And this poem seems to me about the source of poetry. And really seems to me like I'm writing about my higher power almost.
And that's still with you?
That's still with me.
Good. Okay, another one?
Sure. Yeah, this is a very recent one. This one came out of the book. In other words, this is one that came about by writing one a day. I told you I'm a big woods walker. I wear lots and lots of shoes.
Oh, that's good.
I wear them out. And I've had a pair of boots now. They're Columbias, and I've had them 2 or 3 years. I've had them resoled a couple times, and they're still hanging on. So this is an homage to my boots. Boots. Like a lover, I squeeze inside their safe spaces until they feel just right. Unlike others, these fit tight as second skin the first time I set my size 11s into them. Hugging ankles, they point me firmly in the right direction. We've crossed a lot of water, plunged down banks, strode straight down drought-dusty July roads. Their soles have gripped stone, spiriting me up to bluffs where they kept me grounded, though my arms wanted to fly. Waiting patiently in the back seat floor while I drive, their silence suits my own. We ask each other no questions, seek neither kindness nor mercy. The love that leather engenders is better without expectations. Look, there they sit in sunlight, sweat and creek water drying, seams stitched back after bursting, leaking only a little now, letting me know that, like me, they're not going to last forever, but they're plenty good enough for right now.
And that's plenty good enough for right now.
I hope so. I think so.
Another sounds as though it's pretty realistic.
Yeah, very realistic, yeah.
Okay, next one.
All right, Uncle Frank and the Boy is a poem about a friend of mine. I had a good friend and colleague at Sinclair for a number of years. His name is Chuck Wagner, and his office is right next to mine. And he told me about growing up. In summers, he would work for his Uncle Frank, and he did that throughout his teenage years. And I heard that story, and then one night, Conrad, recently, within a year, he told this story with so much detail that it rooted in my brain and became this poem.
The story of Uncle Frank.
Uncle Frank. Uncle Frank and the Boy. Uncle Frank rolled his smokes one-handed, washed his hair in Ajax every week beneath the pump's glittering stream. 7 summers Chuck worked as his uncle's hired hand, from 12 to 19, in the care of a bachelor farmer who served himself and the boy 4 beers a day, even after Grandma came to stay. She never asked what man and boy were doing at the trough after dark, where they'd stand and drink and watch the stars. Back to Detroit by autumn, back to friends and a mother grateful for a son spared the street. Chuck must have been bereft. No rising at sunrise, no chores, no tractor, no hay, no trough, no calf's liver suppers cooked on a wood stove. Too young to know he'd brought home more than muscles, tough and tan. He'd cultivated the man he'd be for the rest of his life.
And we have one more.
Yeah. I'd always wanted to write a novel about my step-grandmother, who was a very interesting person in my life, very important to my life. Very stern and strict, but man, she could cook. So this poem has cooking in it, dedicated to my grandmother. Communion. Sundays, we went to my grandmother's house. Granddad was there too, but like me, he watched his manners around our boss. Chicken hissed in the griddle in that dark kitchen where she cut out biscuits with a glass. We'd jam around the table and she'd pass us mashed potatoes, gravy, tomatoes, and corn. She was the queen of all she surveyed, as willing to slap my mama as me. Often someone fled the table in tears. She called me finicky and forced me to choke down foods I didn't like till I gagged. I was grown and grandmother gone when I heard how she came to keep house for a man whose wife died after giving birth to her 9th. She had taken the chance to flee the father who had misused, if not abused, his daughter. I marvel how a maid, a beauty they say, stayed to reign over such a childlike clan, some as old as my mother, some as young as I. She strived to save them and died trying. Today I see those Sundays a silent tableau, all eyes on her face as she passes us more of herself than we will ever be able to receive.
Very good, Ed. You have a way of perceiving objects, nature, people, friends, relatives, all the world about you, and catching those impressions in very effective words.
Thank you, Conrad. You're very kind.
And thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Ed Davis.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Emily McCord, and I'm joined by Bill Cohen with the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau today. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
Governor Kasich gave his second State of the State speech this week. Bill, let's begin by focusing on the content of what did he say. What was the main takeaway of this speech?
Well, I guess it would be him saying, jobs, 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 we're alive again, Ohio's economy is making a comeback. I think that was probably the theme he wanted people to hear. It's not a particularly new theme. We've heard him say this for several months now. It's part of his stock speech when he speaks to various groups around Ohio. He knew that, that Ohioans, some of them, would be watching and listening throughout the state, and this was a chance that he had to hammer home that point. He made the point, for instance, that a year ago Ohio was something like 48th among the states in terms of job creation, and now there's a new survey which says we've moved up to number 9. And there were a lot of other statistics he gave, but that was, again, the general theme, hey, we're making a comeback.
So were there any particular policies that he set forth in his State of the State speech addressing job creation?
Nothing we heard that was particularly new, and I think that was noteworthy. Most of the time, a governor is doing two things in a State of the State. He or she is saying, this is what I want you to know about where we've been, where we're at. And now I've got several proposals that I want legislators to pass to move us ahead even more. Well, it was that second part we really didn't hear anything. The governor did talk about a couple of somewhat minor proposals like, oh, let's let ex-cons get driver's licenses so they can get jobs. But he's talked about those before. So if you really ask yourself, what new did the governor come up with? There was virtually nothing there. He did make an announcement about how Ohio is enlarging by tenfold its computer internet network that researchers at state universities use when they help corporations, private enterprise come up with research that might yield some new product. So that was somewhat of a new announcement. But again, that wasn't anything he needed legislators to pass. And so if you were looking for something new in the legislative agenda, there really wasn't much there.
So if there wasn't a lot new in terms of policy changes or proposals, what was the reaction from lawmakers in the State House?
Well, as you'd expect, Republicans said it was a great speech. Democrats said, where's the beef? Where's the substance? He spoke for, I don't know, an hour and 20 minutes, something like that. As far as I can tell, that's the longest State of the State address in the last four decades. I don't know if anybody ever had a longer one before that. You know, he was there at Steubenville at the school. He was also there in Steubenville in the heart of fracking country. So a lot of folks thought, well, maybe he's going to unveil something new here on the fracking front. He did talk about oil and gas drilling, and he did say, look, we're not just going to give these oil and gas drillers carte blanche to do whatever they want. We are going to regulate them. We need environmental regulations. We just don't want the environmental regulations to go overboard and mess up the prospect that we're going to have tens of thousands of new jobs here. So he was trying, at least with his words, to strike a middle ground there. He said that before. That's another thing he said before. We need a balance here. So people who are hoping to hear some details about, well, what kind of new regulations is he going to push for, they were disappointed.
And Bill, there were some negative reviews of the speech that were playing out on in the national media. Some liberal organizations have been critical. For example, the mimicking of the shaking of an Ohio State patient with Parkinson's disease, or his reference to Californians as wackadoodles. I'm just curious how his speech played out in front of the audience.
Well, that's hard to tell. I think most of us who've heard the governor before, some of his asides, and his jokes and his references to various things that weren't particularly state government related, they aren't particularly new to us. We've heard this wackadoodles thing before. I would say that I don't believe the governor was making fun of anybody with Parkinson's, so I didn't quite understand why that was implied in some of the national stories that some news media did. But it certainly was accurate that he referenced OSU President Gordon Gee more than a dozen times. It certainly is accurate that he said something about his, quote, hot, unquote, wife, Karen, and it's certainly accurate that he said the folks in California are a bunch of wackadoodles. So some of the national coverage, I think, went a little overboard, but it is, most of it wasn't all that inaccurate.
I've been speaking with Bill Cohen with the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks to all of our guests. And thank you for joining us on member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org. Before we go, here's Sarah Buckingham with a preview of tonight's Sunday Documentary Hour.
Black History Month specials continue, and this week it's Russell Goings' epic griot song, The Children of Children Keep Coming.
Inspired by the artwork of his friend Romare Bearden, Goings spent 13 years writing The Children of Children Keep Coming. Now, through story and song, Goings has adapted his poem into a spoken word performance infused with the improvisational feel of jazz. Narratives of historical figures like Rosa Parks, Sojourner Truth, Frederick Douglass, and Phyllis Wheatley intertwine with mythic characters to tell the story of the African-American journey. The Children of Children Keep Coming, with an introduction by Tony Award winner Brian Stokes Mitchell, tonight at 6 and 11 p.m. on the Sunday Documentary Hour.
And that's it for WISO Weekend. Coming up next, The Book Nook.